Welcome back to the Oklahoma Today podcast. Once again, we are snuggled down in the cozy confines of the Vault 405 in downtown Edmond. We've got Oklahoma Today editors Nathan Gunner.
What's up?
And Greg Elwell. Oh, that's me. Ready to give you a rundown of the best our state has to offer. But before we get into it, the Oklahoma Today podcast is brought to you by MIO, the Made in Oklahoma Coalition. Celebrating its 20th year, the MIO Coalition represents over 70 Oklahoma food processors and agricultural producers. These companies are known for products you can depend on for consistency, quality, taste, and flavor. Local has a name, and the name is MIO, the Made in Oklahoma Coalition. Learn more at www.miocoalition.com.
I'm excited about this, about them, especially right now because it's almost Thanksgiving, Christmas time.
Yes.
And they're a great place to find ingredients.
Yes.
So, yeah. Fresh.
We have a great episode for you today. This week we are joined by the Oklahoma City Museum of Art's Brian Chambers, Manager of Tours and Adult Learning, and exhibition curator Jessica Provencher to talk about Renewing the American Spirit, the Art of the Great Depression, which opened last weekend at the museum. Guys, thank you all so much for coming here, and could you tell us a little bit more about the exhibit?
Sure. So the exhibition really kind of examines the diverse responses of artists to the social upheaval and the economic distress that characterized American life during the Depression. So it features, we'll have FSA photographs, paintings, prints, you know, everything to kind of give a little bit of context in the beginning for people who may not know as much about the Depression, and then kind of show them the way a lot of artists at the time responded and the different ways they did that.
Very cool. What's the time range on some of these pieces of art?
So everything should fall pretty much within the period of the Great Depression from 1929 to, I believe the latest work is maybe 1940.
Okay.
Oh, wow.
Okay. One thing, okay, so first of all, kind of nuts and bolts stuff. How does an exhibit like this come to Oklahoma City, and how much are you guys involved in it? Was this something you all designed yourselves?
Yes.
Awesome.
This is an original exhibition.
Okay,
from the
wonderful.
Museum.
Oh, that's cool.
So what's the, tell me a little bit more about the process of choosing this art, and is this something that you were previously interested in or had studied or kind of?
Yeah. Curating is it's my thing. but for this exhibition, we kind of wanted to draw from, you know, one of our strengths in the collection. We wanted to do a permanent collection or an exhibition that was organized around our permanent collection. One of those strengths is our WPA collection. So even though we've had that on display before, this is a bit different because we're drawing from that collection, but also other works in our collection from that time period that maybe don't get out, people don't see, or they don't currently associate with the Depression. Mm. But then also, even though it's, you know, mainly organized around our collection, we have several loans from different institutions throughout Oklahoma, like Philbrook, Gilcrease, the Oklahoma Arts Council.
Oh, wow.
So there will be some works that, you know, people haven't seen at our museum before.
Wow. That's very cool. And correct me if I'm wrong, there's a mural that hasn't been displayed publicly since 1932.
There
is that right?
That is one of the highlights of the exhibition, is one of our more recent acquisitions. I think we got it in 2017. Yeah, it was made for the George Washington Bicentennial Exhibition in 1932, which was at the National Gallery in Washington, D.C., not to be confused with the current National Gallery, because
right.
The Smithsonian Art Museum used to be called the National Gallery. So that was really the Smithsonian American Art Museum that hosted this exhibition. And then after that, it went into a private collection for a bit, and then a gallery owner had it and thought of us. She knew our collection, and we had a relationship with her and asked if we were interested, and of course we were.
Wow.
Wow.
That's
yeah.
Amazing.
It is massive, so you understand why this could go into hiding and be tucked away for decades. It's not an easel painting. It's not something that can be easily displayed, really, even in our spaces. Our art handler guys who that crew had to come up with an original way of suspending it on the wall because it's so cumbersome just because of scale and size.
Yeah.
And we recently had it conserved. We had a person on site working on it for several days. And we really are new eyes to view this massive mural for the first time in decades.
And what I mean, was it originally on a just like on a wall, like a mural we would have in downtown?
Yes.
Or something?
So when it was exhibited, it was part of it was in that exhibition, and part of that exhibition had this thing called the George Washington Bicentennial Frieze, and it was all of these large murals high up on the wall, like all on every wall. So there were about I think it was 14 panels by 13 different artists. So yeah, that's how it was originally displayed. We can't quite display it the same way
sure,
in our
right,
galleries,
yeah.
But.
And who was the artist?
Gardner Hale.
Okay.
Not a household name. Anybody here know his name?
I didn't until I was reading about it the other day in preparation for this. So I'm excited to learn more about him.
I was fascinated by him because he died young in a tragic accident.
Wow.
In California, but in that short time he had to work on a career, make a name for himself, he revitalized a way of plaster painting technique that really goes back hundreds of years, perhaps to the Italian or the Renaissance of the Italian Peninsula. It's labor intensive. It's not the best process if you want a work of art to live a long time. It's a conservation nightmare in many ways. Now, that's separate from what he was commissioned to do for the Washington Bicentennial. This really is a mural painted on a canvas-like mm-hmm. material, so it doesn't have that same sense of permanency of being painted into the wall.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
But he was on his way to revitalizing this monumental scale of painting that had really been lost for some time.
Wow. Has it continued on since then, or did it kind of go back away with him?
I wouldn't say it never resumed its role of being the way to show art in the public sphere.
Sure.
Think the Italian peninsula, like Venice or Rome or Florence, when there are these massive murals trying to tell everyday people like us how to be good citizens. And mm-hmm. also the other side of that would be, this is what would happen if you did things wrong, like not pay your taxes or follow the laws. Hmm. This could happen. And there's always hell involved.
Right, yeah.
So that's where it really found its place in the world of public art. But it's not convenient. We don't have scale and size like that mm-hmm. in the art world. Like most of our collection, smaller works, easel size paintings. And when I say smaller, I'm not like a foot by foot or less. That's not true. I mean, there are large works we have in our collection, but that kind of painting of murals with plaster on that scale is, there's not a lot of spaces for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's usually in a purpose-built space for mm-hmm. something like that.
Sure.
The way these were displayed, at the Bicentennial, the ceilings were so high, it would be like almost all three of our floors, mm-hmm. our three floors of gallery
wow.
spaces. And this is only in our first floor special exhibition gallery. So we can't quite get that sense of looking up at the meaning behind mm-hmm. This subject. It's at eye level. Because in that same exhibition, they had pedestals and other easel paintings and sculptures all around, and this was above you, like looking up to a clear story and seeing stained glass. You would see these murals, and they were temporarily installed, but it looked permanent. The way they put molding around it, it looked like it was a part. It looked like it was part of the architecture.
Wow. Huh. So, how did the Great Depression? You know, you talked a little bit about kind of social upheaval, and what are some of the artistic, for lack of a better word, flourishes that sort of came out of sort of the environment in which a lot of these works were created? What might people see, you know, in these works that would help them to sort of understand this time?
If I could jump in before we get too close to completely branding this exhibition the Depression Show.
Sure.
That's
sure.
Something
yeah.
we've joked about internally
right.
for a long
yeah.
time. All right, friends, how are we going to get right. people to visit
sure,
this
yeah.
exhibition?
Yeah.
So I call it the Anti-Depression Show.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
yeah.
That
I love
seems
that.
To work. Doesn't quite have the zing. but before we get into the actual optics in the exhibition, our institution, it's the New Deal era programs like the WPA and the Federal Art Project, Federal One programs, that's our origin story. There were lots of smaller social organizations who wanted to start a real permanent museum in this new state and city, Oklahoma City. But it wasn't until the federal government under FDR's administration had this crazy idea of paying artists just like you would laborers in the relief rolls or the CCC. Artists need food. They need revenue as well. So these Federal One programs that included the Federal Art Project, the Federal Music Project, we find a lot of the origin stories of our arts and cultural organizations within this time period, within those federal monies coming into our state. And so a lot of our identity as an institution is wrapped up into this. Like Jessica mentioned, our first objects in our collection were objects from the Federal Art Project. Now, they're not necessarily the best as far as quality, because you really had to crank out works of art. If you said, I wanted to receive relief funds, I wanted some kind of stipend, I'm going to make this, this, and this. You signed it, the regional supervisor signed it. If you didn't produce that, you were kicked off the rolls.
Wow.
So in this case, done is better than better. So it really was about quantity over quality.
Hmm.
Also during this time period, on the Federal Art Project rolls were artists like Mark Rothko and Jackson Pollock. We don't have examples of those objects in our collection, but those are the some of the earliest figurative works by these artists, and largely forgotten by most people who are fans of those two artists, because they moved into, of course, the painterly abstraction, pure abstraction, non-representational or non-objective art. It's large color fields in Rothko's case, or drip paintings that are also large by Pollock. But one of the rules of the Federal Art Project is that you had to capture something that was still figurative, so you had to look at it and somewhat be able to decipher what everything was. But that's not to say that everything was highly natural or the closest stylistic period before that would be like European Romanticism, where everything was over the top and swirling and telling this great dramatic story. Mm-hmm. The goal of the art project in many ways was to capture what was happening in your community, in your town, in your backyard. Mm-hmm. So we see a birth of American regionalism that isn't an exact copy of what was happening in Europe, which was really every mode of artistic expression we had before that. And the same thing happens in music with artists or composers like Copland. We can hear Americana. We can see Americana. And that's really how we tie a pretty bow in the exhibition. Jessica's done an amazing job of laying out the American scene, the American landscape. But where we start, and Jessica, you could probably jump in here, we start with photographs of photographers, and this is still a time period where photography is not necessarily, I hate this word or this phrase, fine art.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Museums aren't collecting it. Hmm. Artists, well, in this case, photographers like Ansel Adams, later known as an artist, is really standing on a soapbox preaching about the wonders of photography and how this is just a new medium. And it doesn't displace all of the work of painters and trying to capture that moment in time. This is different. So eventually, the artists in the exhibition who are in this photography section are recognized and for their contributions to the art world. Artists like Dorothea Lange, probably the iconic image when you walk in, and it's right in front of you, is Migrant Mother. It became the quintessential image of what the Depression meant for everyday people. What would you add, Jessica, about that first section?
Oh, about the first section?
Yeah.
We'll have on display probably the main artist you associate with FSA photography. He said Dorothea Lange.
Mm-hmm.
We also have Walker Evans, a photograph by Walker Evans, several works by Russell Lee. After we do some rotations of the photographs midway through the exhibition, we'll have some works by Arthur Rothstein out and one of his most iconic photographs, the Dust Storm.
Mm-hmm.
That section is really, like I said, to kind of give a little bit of context to some people who maybe don't understand or are not familiar with with the hardship that was going on at that time, what people were experiencing, and you know, what all of the artists after that we see in the exhibition, what exactly they were all responding to. And so, you know, going back to your question about, you know, what kind of like themes you'll see throughout the exhibition, you know, this was a time when artists were trying to produce a distinctly American vision. They were drawing from subject matter that would have been familiar to, you know, everyday people. Things were subject matter that was unique to America, and so, you know, one of the first things we talk about in the exhibition after the photographs is looking to the past. A lot of artists during the 1930s looked to the past and, you know, depicted past events, these nostalgic images that, you know, could be a reminder of a better time, or even they would depict well-known historical figures like George Washington or Abraham Lincoln. You know, they were trying to look to inspirational examples of people who had triumphed over adversity, or, you know, really trying to produce these reassuring images that, you know, would kind of try to give people the idea that, you know, this can be overcome, like things can get better, or, you know, just something that wasn't, you know, constantly reminding them of the hardship many were facing at this time.
Yeah.
And then so other things you'll see throughout the exhibition is portraiture and just depictions of ordinary American people. A lot of artists paid a lot of attention to just ordinary Americans during this time. So we'll have several portraits and just, you know, depictions of everyday life, as well as urban and rural landscapes. That was probably one of the biggest themes, was just the American landscape, painting the American scene. There were many painters at that time that were interested in capturing, you know, modern American life, what was going on around them.
Wow.
I feel like I'm understanding a little bit more the idea of this as the anti-depression show, because
yeah.
It really is. It's like, yes, the Great Depression is happening, and there are lots of scenes that are depicting mm-hmm. what is happening at the time and trying to document that, but it's also art as a panacea, as mm-hmm. as a curative for this. You know, it's like, hold on, it can get better, and you know, I think that's fascinating, and I think kind of also speaks to in some ways the deeper mm-hmm. purpose of art, which is not just to reflect mm-hmm. but also to uplift.
Yeah, well, and that's one of the things that the government recognized, the ability of art to you know, enliven the broken spirit at that time, and FDR in particular thought art was essential to leading an abundant life.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
Oh, which I would assume is something you guys tend to agree with.
Yes.
It's okay. Yeah. And it's interesting, too, that, you know, the WPA especially is something that is so present in Oklahoma, just yeah. in the landscape. You know, I mean, there's mm-hmm. buildings you can – everywhere you look. I mean, in my neighborhood is yeah. Taft Stadium, which is a WPA project. And, you know, and you can drive anywhere in Oklahoma and see what the WPA and the Civilian Conservation Corps did at this time. And this kind of – it's sort of that same thing, right, that – work is worthwhile.
Yeah.
You know, you're giving, no matter what someone is working in, if it's art, if it's construction, if it's whatever, you know, we're giving people something kind of to do
yeah.
and to express themselves in some kind of way to get through this time that we're in.
All of which has a public benefit.
Yeah, exactly.
Roads,
yeah.
bridges. Across yeah. the street from us, there's a PWA, Public Works Administration,
yeah.
Series of buildings. It's now our City Hall, our Civic Center Music mm-hmm. Hall. Our county courthouse tower, and then also something else that we're not talking about, but the old police headquarters,
mm-hmm. yeah.
because it's in a challenge of historic preservation right now.
Mm-hmm.
But those four buildings were originally known as the Civic Center Complex, and they actually published plans to have a second phase after that,
hmm.
where the Art Museum and the Downtown Library would flank the Civic Center Music Hall, the block north of that and south of it. And after entering World War II, those plans weren't realized, but our history, we ended up pretty stinking close to that point.
Yeah. I was going to say, not too far off.
Yeah, our great Norwich Downtown Library, part of the Metropolitan Library System, is a structure that was realized in the first round of MAPS projects. Mm-hmm. We were almost in that list of first round of MAPS projects, but we're cut. We're the next to last on that list, and so we didn't get that chance, but we realized our space through all private fundraising as well as a lead donation from the Reynolds Foundation at the time. So it was realized in a different way, but the possibility was imagined as far back as the 30s.
Hmm. Wow.
And something else, when we were a federal art project institution, known as a couple of things, like a WPA Experimental Gallery, the name changed with every article in local papers. When we started, the Federal Art Project could do a lot of things. You had access to any laborer on the relief rolls, whichever division, whichever area of government. So CCC workers could help paint the walls for a new exhibition, build pedestals, fix your floors, hang art for you. Though it paid for arts education, both the Federal Music Project program and the Federal Art Project really introduced first through 12th grade sequential curriculum in both disciplines throughout our state.
Hmm.
And many districts still had that sequential education because of the impetus of the Federal Music Project or the Federal Art Project. So we had outreach back then. We had art making in the parks throughout Oklahoma City, and that was driven by our institution, the WPA Oklahoma Art Center, another example of a different title. But the one thing the Federal Art Project didn't do, because it wanted local buy-in and support and some sense of collaboration, is pay rent.
Hmm.
So our then director, Nan Sheets, you may know her name because her husband's medical practice and eventually studio for her, the way the story goes, she started what's now JRB at the Elms in Paseo, a great local private gallery. That was originally her space. And so her husband's medical practice, and she decorated the waiting rooms with her paintings. Eventually, she kicked him out, and that became the gallery. So when the assistant director of the Federal Art Project came to Oklahoma City, along pretty much what's now I-35, that's pre-interstate days, and he talked to Nan, she was convinced in her oral history with the Smithsonian, she said, "I was sure he was drunk." Because the federal government didn't do this. But once she realized he's telling the truth, they went to then-director of the Chamber of Commerce, Stanley Draper. And Draper helped us find a series of unrented or unleased, unused spaces downtown until the Civic Center was finished. At that time, the Municipal Auditorium. And we moved into the fifth floor of it. And so just across the street at this other New Deal project, that's where we had our first long-term home.
Hmm, wow.
And that space is still up there. It wasn't redone when the music hall was redone. And the only thing original to it is light fixtures. But there's this terrible wood paneling everywhere when legal aid was there for several decades.
Yeah.
But now it's just this time capsule.
Huh.
And that's another part of our origin story.
Wow. Also a side note about JRB. You can read more about it in our January-February issue of Oklahoma Today because we have a feature about the Paseo District.
That's right.
Fantastic.
Written by our colleague Megan Rossman, which is very exciting. So just a little plug. I'm nothing if not a shameless self-promoter.
Tell me a little bit about, obviously, so the exhibition opened last weekend and people can go in and experience it for themselves, but you guys also do guided tours and classes that kind of coincide with this. Tell me a little bit more about that and how the experience changes. I've always found, anyway, that having someone who knows what they're talking about can open your eyes to art in a very different way.
Yeah, my first life was in music. So earlier when you mentioned that, Greg, about the arts, yeah, it really did connect me to my life's purpose. So my first life in music, and then I switched to the dark side and went to art history in museums. But I realized that I built knowledge around my passion for the arts. I didn't really understand history until I was connecting it to something I was performing or something I was seeing. And then you have this stronger development, this web of knowledge that you build upon for the rest of your life. So when you're walking through an exhibition, you may not be the person who visits every exhibit at the museum. You may have been to one of our past blockbuster exhibitions that you knew something about, maybe Matisse or Picasso or Fabergé, Roman art from the Louvre. So you have some fascination with it from another area of your life. Mm-hmm. We all do the same thing when we walk into an exhibition and we see something. We're trying to find places in our memory and our knowledge banks to help us understand what we're seeing, that context. Sometimes it's obvious, and I'm not saying this is the artist's fault for not making it obvious, but sometimes it helps to have that person open your eyes, get you excited about something, and all of a sudden you're down a slippery slope of trying to digest everything in that exhibition. And if there's one thing I could share with every visitor, those labels are wonderful. Jessica and her team do a wonderful job to make sure every word is correct, something you're all familiar with, too, with Oklahoma Today.
Very much.
But sometimes it takes someone giving you permission to allow you to just see that.
Yeah.
Just to look. You have everything you need to read this work of art, to experience this work of art. It doesn't take a paragraph or two next to it to say why it's valuable. And sometimes a person facilitating that experience, like in a public tour, which we'll have twice a month for the run of the exhibition, visit okcmoa.com to sign up for your tour. And they're led by different people on staff. Some of them are led by volunteers. And each of those facilitators, those guides, bring something different, their own experience, their own background. They'll have different key works that they focus on. So it's like having a best friend walk you through the exhibition. there are layers and layers of meaning for those public tours, and I think that's the best benefit. Now, other programming like classes, camps, no camps this round, but classes and workshops will try to build on an art-making experience, or rather a tour, and then an art-making experience, so you have something tangible and manipulative to build on what you just saw in the exhibition. Maybe that's an object or a painting or a sculpture that's worthy of display in your home, for example, the refrigerator, or you actually have it framed.
This is one of the things that I love about OKCMOA especially, is it just seems like there is really, really something for everybody. You can go and have this very complete experience while you're there. You know, I could spend an entire day. I could spend a week, I feel like, just in the galleries, right, just looking. Yeah. But there's the restaurant. There's films. Yeah. There's the rooftop in the summer. There's the event space. It just seems like there is really something to call to every single person.
I'm partial to come the gift to the shop.
I am addicted to that gift shop. I can't even go in because I know that I will damage my credit rating.
We have so many. How many times have we walked in there and been like, well, I guess I'm going to buy every enamel pin that they sell.
Yeah. When I bring my giant stack of purchases up every time, I say to the clerk, stop me before I stop myself.
Oh, guess what she's right? Not going to do.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
But that's one of our that's us fulfilling our mission, Nathan.
Yeah.
We're living our mission, enriching lives through the visual arts. It's not just what's on view in the galleries. It's everything we do throughout that building, from our film program. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, it's a great story now we have in Oklahoma City because we have many independent cinemas and movie theaters. Yeah. We used to be the only place where you can find that one independent film, and it was probably showing one screening on a Thursday night. Yep. We have more options now. But the museum is your destination for a whole list of experiences that we crave. We need in our community.
Yeah.
And I'm happy to say that even though our exhibitions are fantastic, there's so much more to the story.
Absolutely.
Well, you know, one thing I always think about with OKCMOA is, and I truly hate this phrase that has been painted all over Oklahoma City, but the idea of a big league city. You know, and everybody was just, it was like, we have the thunder, we have the thunder, which is great. Like, I love the thunder. It's wonderful that they're here. However, I always, it's kind of like, it's like telling people that, you know, that we bought the weather vane on top of the Devon Tower, and that made us the big league city. And it's like, yeah, but we had to build a tower first for it to be up there. And OKC MOA and so much of our art community, and then, I mean, so a lot of, I don't want to call them little things, but a lot of the building blocks of Oklahoma City becoming a quote-unquote true city have been there for decades and decades, and now we are seeing, I think, all of this coming to fruition.
Yeah.
And you guys have been such an integral part of that, because when people do come to the city, and came in the past, and when we didn't have a professional team, and we didn't have quite as bustling a scene in our various districts, OKC MOA was this shining light that was like, no, you got to take this town seriously. Look at look at this 3-story tall Chihuly, and you know, Warhols and everything else as you're traveling through the galleries, and you're like, no, this is here. This is we are not just a flyover. You know,
you guys are a cornerstone.
Yeah,
really.
Thank you. That means we're living our passion and our mission. So
it's good.
But to that note, Greg, when I started at the museum 14 years ago, we opened in that space in 2002, and I started 2005. And when I worked evenings, no one was downtown. It was still a downtown that shut down after business hours.
Oh, yeah.
And we were the only restaurant in downtown for the longest time. If you want to go to the Civic Center and see a performance by whichever arts organization or performing arts organization, your only place to eat was the Museum Cafe. And then several things came online. It's your analogy with the Devon Tower. It works because we watched that tower go up. And then around it, things like the Thunder, new buildings for arts and cultural organizations, new organizations, and this drive to just to keep creating. It really brought all of Oklahoma City together in a way that wasn't centralized around place. It wasn't centralized around an identifiable location. And in some ways, not tooting our own horn, well, maybe I should just own that.
No, toot away.
Shameless plug. Yeah. When that building, the old Center Theater was repurposed into the new Oklahoma City Museum of Art, It was a catalyst for everything else that was happening within the Arts District.
That's exciting. So obviously we have the great, I'll call it the anti-depression exhibition there that people should absolutely go see. And when? How long is it open?
Jessica?
It is open from November 2nd to April 26th.
Fantastic. So Wonderful. Go see that. What's coming up?
Is it time? I think we can share.
About?
Yeah, Pop Power.
Pop Power. That will be next summer's show.
Wow. Tell us all about this. This is exciting.
Yeah. So it's all from the collection of Jordan Schnitzer. He has probably one of the biggest works on paper collection in the country.
He has the largest private works on paper collection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. And so this exhibition will feature basically all of the biggest names in pop art.
Oh, this is exciting.
But we'll also have, you know, we'll start it with some, you know, some of the more familiar names of pop art. But then it also has some newer artists that people might recognize from neo-pop art.
Okay. Give us some examples.
Murakami.
Okay. Oh, that's exciting. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. So it's a blockbuster exhibition with, I mean, every person you think of when you think pop art, they're in it.
Oh, the Warhols and the Lichtensteins.
The Warhols, the Lichtensteins.
Oh, this is very exciting. This is this is my favorite.
Yes.
That's fantastic. Great.
Movement in art, so I am going to be there every day.
That's fantastic. Yeah, what Jessica started with is how we make exhibitions and how we program that schedule. It's really important to us to have that diversity, where we can organize our own exhibitions with our collection, maybe pull in a few loans like this exhibition to tell a bigger, perhaps new angle on something that's been told a few times, which we hope to do with the Renewing the American Spirit, the Art of the Great Depression.
Great.
But we also want to bring in exhibitions that are perhaps traveling, partner with private collections, other museums. They've originated an exhibition, and we want to be a venue for them because our community needs this too.
Absolutely. I remember the most recently, the Mellon Collection.
That was so great.
Blown away. And I want to thank you. Jessica was a huge, huge help to me in trying to understand the art and kind of dig a little below the surface. Thank you so much for being here today. I really appreciate it. Once again, Renewing the American Spirit, the Art of the Great Depression is open now at the Oklahoma City Museum of Art. Go there. Sign up for a tour. Eat in the restaurant. Shop in the gift shop. Enjoy it. We have such an amazing... OKCMOA is such an amazing resource and destination in Oklahoma City. Thank you guys again for being here. We've got some events, Nate.
Speaking of destinations, there's a lot going on.
A lot happening across the state. November 5th, the Native Hippie presents a custom earring class in Lawton. Open your ears and possibly earlobes for a jewelry making workshop for all skill levels. Materials will be provided, and some of those materials include snacks, sodas, and wine. Take home only the earrings you create in class, but also a template to make more jewelry at home. Tickets are $30 at thenativehippie.com.
This is fun. That sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah. I'm going to see
if my mom wants
earrings
to go to that.
In years.
Wine plus making things. Doesn't that sound like something she would enjoy?
Yeah,
I should note, by the way, for the record, that I've known Brian Chambers since I was 15, and he's one of my favorite people and dearest friends in the entire world, and he knows my mom quite well. So he knows how much fun she would think that would be. November 6th. Get crazy for some. I'm already crazy. Get crazy for some sharp dressed men as ZZ Top comes to Enid on their 50th anniversary tour. Man, I love them. Don't you just love ZZ Top? Stride. I do, man. Jesus Just Left Chicago. Are you kidding me? That's a great song. Stride Bank Center will host a whole lot of beard with tickets starting at $37. Unlike most 50th anniversaries, this is one celebration guaranteed to get loud. I don't know. I plan on just getting louder every year. Visit stridebankcenter.com for more info.
November 7th, Tahlequah has seen its fair share of severe weather over the years, seeing as we're in Oklahoma and all. But it's a different storm a-coming when Colorado-based Thunder and Rain bring their Americana bluegrass sound to the Northeastern State University Center for the Performing Arts. Tickets are $10 to $20. Go to nsuok.edu to learn more.
Also, Tahlequah is just a fun place to visit all the time. November 8th, we should ask the boys from the Tales Unveiled podcast, they were on the show recently, if there are any ghosts in Tulsa's Kane's Ballroom. I just bet there are, don't you? But there are different spirits headed to that hallowed ground. Giving Spirits is a whiskey tasting event benefiting the Community Food Bank of Eastern Oklahoma. That is an amazing organization. Mm-hmm. Great time of year to help benefit them. Featuring tastings of whiskey-inspired recipes from Food Bank executive chef Jeff Marlowe, as well as live music from the Scott McQuaid Trio. The event also includes seminars on the world of whiskey. Tickets start at $150. Visit okfoodbank.org for more. Who doesn't love some good whiskey? Especially in service of a good cause.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
On November 9th, Mike Hostey, a man who can perform solo in a duo or a trio, and we assume with groups of any size, plays the State Theater in Hera. He's joined by opening acts Space Cowboy from Norman and Oklahoma City artist Taylor Atkinson. Tickets are $12 to $15 on ticketstorm.com.
Mike Hostey is it's always a great show. Mm-hmm. It's fun to see. November 10th, it's Snakes on the Plains, not Snakes on a Plane. Snakes on the Plains at the Oklahoma City Reptile Show, which slithers into the Biltmore Hotel for a day chock full of critters. In addition to reptiles, small exotic mammals such as sugar gliders and hedgehogs will also make an appearance. That's fun. Tickets are $3 to $8 at coldbloodedexpos.com.
Mm-hmm. Once again, thank you guys for listening, and be sure to subscribe to the podcast. Make sure you don't miss an episode. Rate and review us online and send any questions or comments to oktpod@travelok.com. And please visit oklahomatoday.com/subscribe to make sure you don't miss a single issue of our magazine. The Tulsa issue just hit newsstands, and I think it's safe to say this is an issue we're really proud of.
Yeah, and the next one is the Oklahoma City issue.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we've got, among other things, a 40-page special section dedicated to the 25th anniversary of the Oklahoma City bombing, which is in 2020. Some really powerful stuff in that issue and some great stuff in the Tulsa issue. We're just having a blast making these.
Absolutely. Yeah. Do us a favor and tell your friends and family, enemies, coworkers, strangers on the street to give us a listen. We would love to be in more people's ears. And thank you again for joining us on the Oklahoma Today podcast. We'll talk to you again next week.
People of America, I regret to inform you today the stock market, it has plummeted